Yeah, I mean, anytime you invent a new kind of hammer, you just want to bang everything with it. And I think that's sort of what sequencing and bioinformatics have been for the past 10 or 15 years. And, you know, to their credit, I think we've learned a ton about the microbial world from those new technologies. But I think you're also totally spot on that, you know, in order to really connect to mechanism and understand the associations and patterns we're seeing, we do need to go back into the wet lab and actually grow bugs and manipulate them.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is Sean Gibbons from the Institute for Systems Biology. Tell us about your work. Tell us about the kind of work you do and how it connects to probiotics, prebiotics, and the area our listeners might be interested in.
Sure. So I consider myself a microbial ecologist by training. I started off in Montana, actually, in the Nyack River, which is just outside of Glacier National Park. And I was digging around in the sediments and growing bugs out of the sediments and you know, characterizing their metabolism and the communities that live there, mostly with pre-sequencing methods like DGGEs and, you know, lipid profiles and things like that. And then over time, I sort of moved more into computational biology, theoretical ecology and evolution. And I did my postdoc with Eric Alm at MIT, and that's where I really kind of moved into poop. And that's where I've been ever since, kind of stuck with that. So my lab would say we're about 70% computational and 30% experimental. Most of what we do is sort of design bioinformatic tools for exploring and also manipulating these complex ecologies with the ultimate goal of, you know, understanding the rules well enough to be able to engineer the outputs of the system and perhaps even treat or cure, prevent disease.
That's fascinating description of what you do. And I'm very old school. I think bioinformatics has ruined microbiology. Okay, I'm overstating it just to make a point, but do you think there's a danger that people are moving far too much into the computational and not backing it up with the biology or having enough biologists around to kind of gut check the outputs of the bioinformatic tools?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you invent a new kind of hammer, you just want to bang everything with it. And I think that's sort of what sequencing and bioinformatics have been for the past 10 or 15 years. And, you know, to their credit, I think we've learned a ton about the microbial world from those new technologies. But I think you're also totally spot on that, you know, in order to really connect to mechanism and understand the associations and patterns we're seeing, we do need to go back into the wet lab and actually grow bugs and manipulate them. You know, I started off in the wet lab and moved into computation. And so I've always had that piece. I've always had that, you know, virtuous cycle in mind of, sure, we can do all kinds of modeling and complex stuff on the computational side. But at the end of the day, it's you got to validate it. You got to test it in the lab. And if you find something weird or new or different, you can use that information to feed back into this modeling and improve how that part's done. So I think having both and being able to iterate is crucial. And I see a lot of that now in the literature. I think that we're in a phase now where that's starting to happen more and more, which is great.
Yes, I have to say, Sean, I appreciate the role that you've played and other systems biologists have played in trying to help us figure out mechanisms. So for example, you were senior author on a really important paper talking about the use and abuse of correlation analysis. And as a statistician, I appreciate that because all we can do is say that there's an association, but we can't necessarily figure out directionality. But you kind of point out you have to sort of combine the analytical frameworks with experimentation. So can you talk to us a little bit about the role of the microbial communities, their uniqueness, and how that complicates trying to tease out mechanism? Specifically, I'm thinking between a prebiotic and a health outcome in an animal or a human.
It's
a complicated question, but...
Complicated question.
Yes.
But I think it's the crux, right? It's the crux of why probiotics have been so hard to translate or to show strong efficacy. I mean, I truly believe that probiotics are super efficacious, but they're also super context specific, right? They might work really well here and less so there. And when you do a trial, that gets all kind of averaged out and dampened out. part of the necessity of this modeling and systems biology is we're living in a kind of new era from what we were in the 20th century, right? In the 20th century, it was often, you know, reductionist. You would kind of zoom in to a single organism or a small subset of your system, tease it apart, cut it apart, and disentangle the mechanisms of what's going on. And that's, we learned a ton from doing that. You know, the human knowledge grew a huge amount from that. But it turns out that if you take a protein or an organism that you characterize in isolation and you put it into the context of a community or a host organism, it behaves completely differently than it did in your model system. So how do we get to the point where we can begin to integrate the complexity of all that context dependency? You have to rely on our artificial intelligence type tools or mechanistic model tools that are able to capture all that information, integrate it, and try to predict emergent outputs of the system rather than, you know, focusing in on a single organism. And that's a really hard problem. And there's been a lot of great work in the last couple of decades to try to get to solutions. And I think, you know, in the next few years, we're really going to start to see we're going to be able to cash that check to some extent.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. So as a statistician who's thinking about how claims can be made and how those have to be applicable to sort of a larger population. And I appreciate you pointing out the weaknesses of reductionism and how you have to put things into a context. But when you're talking about a context, do you mean human gut microbes, or do you mean Dan's gut microbe is a different context than Colin's gut microbe? So it's basically more or less impossible to be able to make population level health claims because the context, the microbial ecology matters so much that it even matters from person to person.
Yes. So I think the easiest way to conceptualize this is in the phenomenon of non-responders. And this is not only for microbiome, right? This is a common thing we see all over the place in drugs. So there was this Shork paper from 2015 in Nature where he talked about the top 10 highest grossing drugs in the United States, they're only efficacious in at best 1 in 4 people, or at worst 1 in 24 people. So in the majority of people are actually non-responders to some of these really dominant pharmaceuticals that are on the market. And yet the effect sizes are large enough that they survive in these trials, right? The effect survives and they're able to prescribe it. But the companies kind of don't like to talk about the fact there's a lot of non-responders. And they definitely don't have to deal with the sticky problem of how do you rescue those non-responders. That's a hard problem. They would rather be able to target responders and only give their drugs to the responders than have to figure out how to target and save the non-responders. So that's a fundamental challenge in pharmaceuticals. I think that's the same problem in probiotics. If you give 20 people the same organism, you're going to have different effect sizes across that group of people. And there are things one can do to perhaps modulate those effects. So, you know, what is the person eating, their dietary input? Perhaps you can make them responders if you have them eat a banana along with their probiotic. But how do you understand those combinatorics also in the background context of their own microbiomes and that composition and in the context of their genomes? And there's just so much complexity to all of this. So it's a hard problem.
I could follow up on that, Sean. If let's suppose we could show that, you know, and it has been shown, I think, to some extent that maybe responding and non-responding to checkpoint inhibitors has a microbiome component to it. But let's say we can establish that a particular community structure or community functionality is making you a non-responder to a probiotic or a frontline drug or whatever it might be. What do you think are the major levers that we have for manipulating the microbiome in a directed manner to make deliberate changes in a deliberate direction, if you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, and it's really early days for understanding what is the best lever there. Obviously, diet is a big one, but as far as changing the diet to push the system in a like predictable direction, like that's not a solved problem at all. Some work I helped out with in my postdoc was to try to design what we were calling orthogonal niches for organisms. And I know the Sonnenberg lab has also worked on this, and you know, we had a similar approach where we were using Bacteroides plebeius, which was this gut bug isolated from Japanese people that had taken up a gene cassette to metabolize porphyrin, which is the polysaccharide in seaweed. And most gut bugs can't break down seaweed. And so we used that compound as essentially a niche that nothing else had access to that you could use to put into the diet and hold an organism that would normally not be indigenous in the system. and you could turn it on and turn it off by removing or replacing that niche. Our lab is working more generally on the problem of understanding the metabolic niche from the whole diet perspective. So you can actually simulate the community metabolic capacity of the gut microbiome and also simulate the dietary inputs and ask, you know, can you tune the metabolic niche of any given organism to turn off or turn on its ability to engraft or colonize a given person? And we have one proof of concept preprint on C. diff, where we're trying to show that we can indeed predict, you know, engraftment likelihood of C. diff. But we hope to extend that type of approach to probiotics and other organisms as well.
Do you think that we need a scientist to be able to name things, of course, so we can discuss them and talk about them meaningfully? But are we obsessed with names for bugs and, you know, almost giving magical qualities to names and Faecalibacterium prysnitzii? If that's up, that's good. And if it's down, it's bad. And not focusing too much on functionality and, you know, do you have a bug doing something that's named differently to the same bug in me doing the same thing? And we're losing sight of the essence of what the microbiome is doing, which is functions, not, you know, it's not a zoo where you can visit every bacterium you want to name.
Yeah, great point. And I think that's, again, getting at this, the difficulty, the functional redundancies that exist in the microbiome. These are, you know, thousands and thousands of species that any given person maybe has a hundred or a couple hundred of them, and somehow they still have a functional set, even though those compositions vary greatly. We've been doing a little bit of work with Ophelia Venturelli on some not yet published stuff, where she has these little toy communities of butyrate producers, and you can modulate the other organisms living with them in these synthetic communities. And any given bug, like F. prow or any other butyrate producer, its amount of butyrate production varies quite a lot, depending on who it's living around. And so what we really need are reliable tools for making that mapping between taxonomic composition and functional outputs, whether those outputs are metabolites or, you know, immunomodulatory antigens and proteins that are being produced by the microbiome or so on.
I appreciate, as a mathematician, the way that you describe that. You say you'd want to be able to map how compositional changes lead to different functional outputs. And I think mathematically you're thinking, oh, well, that's a many to one mapping. Like, in other words, you can get the same functional outputs from many different roads, many different kinds of compositional changes. Is that how you think about it?
That's exactly how we think about it. And it's what we see in our modeling work and in our in vitro cultivation work, where we have these poop soups, essentially, or ex vivos, if you will, where you take fresh stool and incubate it in the anaerobic chamber and dietary components to those incubations. And you see that there's a wide variation in, for example, short-chain fatty acid production with fluxomic measurements, time series metabolomics. And there's also some people who have the exact same output, but they have completely different compositions. So it is a many-to-one mapping.
Can you tell me, and I'm asking this from somebody that was listening to your amazing talk at our plenary meeting and thinking, this guy is great. And then you start talking about artificial intelligence, and there was a part of me that was like, well, artificial intelligence is only as smart as the inputs that it has. So can you tell me how you're imagining that artificial intelligence will be able to help us if the main problem we have is we don't know what the mapping is from the compositional changes to the functional outputs? Are you thinking that artificial intelligence will be able to make us realize that we know things we don't already know? Or do you think it'll actually be able to help us realize that there are ways to get to a certain functional output through compositional changes we hadn't yet envisioned? Like, it'll be able to use pure biology, chemistry, and physical considerations combined with what we already know to figure out things that we haven't already known?
Yeah, that's... I have a similar teeth gritting response when I hear someone say artificial intelligence, because you don't know what they're talking about. But it's also useful to say for like grants, and, you know, it's obviously a buzzword that people use. I mean, and at the end of the day, it's just statistical modeling, right?
Well, that's what I mean. Like, is it generating new knowledge, or is it only helping you figure out better from the data we already have what the relationships are?
Yeah. And, you know, the one way of framing it is, if you go back into the history of artificial intelligence research, there's actually two different branches of it, you know, and one is very much statistical and, you know, kind of focusing on things like neural nets and so on. And that's really about extracting knowledge new knowledge, whereas there's another sort of symbolic AI family of modeling where you actually have knowledge already, right? Maybe it's Newtonian mechanics. And so you can bake that into a system of equations that you can use to make predictions about a system. And we've done a bit of both. Honestly, we actually work with these large, what we're calling deep phenotyping cohorts, where we've measured a lot of stuff about humans and their microbiomes and try to back out novel associations and things like that from statistical modeling. But the metabolic modeling stuff I was talking about, that falls into the symbolic AI family, where we actually have huge knowledge graphs of the metabolic capacities of all the organisms in the gut. We know what enzymes they have. We know the metabolites that go in, come out of these various enzymatic reactions, and we can build genome scale metabolic models for those organisms. Couple those genome scale models together into a community scale model, and then couple that with a dietary input, and then use that to make an emergent prediction. So we're not actually fitting anything in that kind of model. There's no statistics. It's all based on knowledge, and then we're setting the initial conditions of the model based on data, right? So we can adjust the abundances of all the microbes in the model, and we can adjust the composition of the species in the model based on someone's microbiome that you've sampled. But you're not, you know, there's no other parameters you're really fitting. And so your predictions are essentially based on knowledge, not based on statistical fitting.
I can bring the conversation back down a little bit to a level that I'll be able to understand. Do you see, Sean, that in 20, 50 years' time, that a general practitioner, a family physician, that taking microbiome readings, for want of a better term, will just be a frontline standard, like doing a standard blood test, and that decisions of pharmacy or diet will be based on the microbiome? Or do you think the microbiome will fade into the background as noise because of this level of diversity and difference between people?
I strongly do believe that it will be a part of clinical medicine in the future. There will be some component of our precision or personalized response to interventions that cannot be explained by other factors other than the microbiome. We had a paper last year on statins, the drug statin, which are LDL-lowering cholesterol drugs, and we found that there are known genomic markers that can predict efficacy of statins. But if you accounted for those and then looked at the microbiome, the microbiome actually explained a larger fraction of the response to these drugs, both in terms of the on-target response for LDL lowering, but also in terms of some side effects, including insulin resistance and you know, prediabetes. And the sort of statistical modeling gave us some new information there, where we think we might have some levers to make statin prescriptions more precision by giving co-therapies, both prebiotic and probiotic, to sort of improve the on-target efficacy and shield people from the metabolic consequences of statins. And, you know, we looked at statins just because we had enough data for it from a random population that we had sampled because so many people take them. But I suspect that many drugs fall into this same camp, that the composition of your microbiome is super informative of how you respond. We know this for some cancer drugs, and we know this now for statins and a few other drugs. The same is going to be true for diet and for lifestyle interventions, immunotherapy, and so on. So I do, you know, we're not there yet in terms of having a clinician get a, you know, maybe a tablet with an easy readout that, you know, puts the data in and they get out a simple kind of decision support for what to do with that information. I think that's a huge challenge, but I do think it's coming.
And a question I get a lot from people, and I'm going to just dump it onto you now and see what your answer is should we be, you know, much more careful isn't a good enough expression, because we should be more careful, but should we almost be restricting antibiotic use? Because if you believe the microbiome is a significant player in human health, you know, we're going to have to manipulate that in very precise ways in order to improve human health. Do you think that the benefits of antibiotics still outweigh the potential detrimental effect of antibiotics?
I mean, it depends a lot on how they're used, right? If people are prescribing them for colds, then yeah, that's not great. But of course, antibiotics have saved maybe billions of lives. Yeah. I'm not sure how many lives they've saved. You got a paper cut a century ago and you would die from it. Yeah. So we don't live in that world anymore, and that's a good thing. So I wouldn't say that, you know, we shouldn't give antibiotics out. They're definitely crucial. But I think that there has been this hidden cost to them that we haven't been accounting for properly. Just like, you know, we didn't account for fossil fuels cost properly, and now we're dealing with the consequences of that. to me, the solution is probably more along the lines of remediation, environmental remediation, you know, having a co-therapy where maybe you prescribe a high fiber diet and a cocktail of, you know, important commensal gut microbes that one takes following an antibiotic treatment regime, or even following like a bowel prep, which we know also affects the composition and can lead to colonization by opportunistic organisms or traveler's diarrhea, what have you. Anytime there's a perturbation down there, have some sort of recovery on the other end of it. But I think there's a good association with like overuse of antibiotics in certain windows of life in particular, like maybe certain parts of childhood that could be especially detrimental to like long-term immunomaturation. Mm. So maybe we can adjust how we deploy them a little bit, but I think they're probably always going to be in the arsenal.
Yeah.
So Colin's question, Sean, makes me wonder also about, I know it's difficult enough for us to figure out what's going on with just the human when the human is the host, but have you given thought or are you involved in any projects that try to look at the impact of antibiotics and other things on larger systems? You know, like we're feeding antibiotics to animals and that impacts ecologies at all kinds of different scales. And, you know, humans are just part of a larger network. So have you thought about how your tools could be used for, you know, for things where it's not just a single host, but or it's across many different scales?
Yeah, it's a great question. We haven't, you know, our lab's only 5 years old and we've focused on the things we've focused on. So we haven't done a ton of, like what you're saying, I think relates a lot to kind of an evolutionary perspective of looking at the movement of these gene cassettes and genes across organisms in different systems under different land use practices or different lifestyle practices. I am a co-author, though, with some old colleagues from my postdoc lab, Mathieu and Mathilde, who are Mathieu Groussin and Mathilde Poyer, who are at Kiel University in Germany. And they are the progenitors of the Global Microbiome Conservancy, where they've gone around the world and sampled a lot of different populations of humans with different lifestyles. And there was a paper in Cell last year or 2 years ago, and they did a really interesting analysis looking at the effect of human lifestyle practices on horizontal gene transfer among commensal gut microbes. And they found that there were big differences. So the rates of horizontal transfer between microbes in a given person's gut were much higher in the developed world, in essentially the US and Europe, than they were in other places, which was not quite expected.
Can you explain for our listeners why that's a particularly worrisome bit of news?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of times when you're passing these genes around, it's because you're under some kind of stress and you're trying to resist that stress. So that could be antimicrobials, or it could be inflammation or what have you, different things that they could be stressed out by. So maybe there's more chemicals in our diet or we're exposed to more things that these microbes are needing to resist and evolve against. That being said, you know, another pattern that they found was that the types of genes being passed around were quite different depending on lifestyle. And you might expect that antimicrobial resistance genes are enriched in the developed world, but that wasn't the case. So they actually found that these farming communities, these kind of nomad people who live with their animals, they had the highest rates of antimicrobial resistance transfer in their HGTs. And that particular group of folks, they live with their animals and they give their animals antibiotics. So I think it is related to agriculture and their lifestyle practices, but not in the developed world. So that was sort of a surprising result.
Yeah, this is amazing stuff. And I think we go on talking about this forever. Is there any message you'd like to get across from the work you've been doing of, you know, to just predict where this field is going, particularly of relation to prebiotics or probiotics? Do you think we'll inevitably move towards the kind of, the buzzword is next generation probiotics, or completely different types of prebiotics are predicted by the genetic capabilities of the organisms we want to favor? Do you think that's the direction we're heading in?
That is what I hope. I mean, our lab is actually working hard on trying to develop tools for precision prebiotics, probiotics, and dietary interventions, mostly through our metabolic modeling work. So I think that is definitely an avenue to go down. We've thrown out too many babies with the bathwater, I think, in the past. A lot of probiotics, whether they're next generation or not, although I'm very excited about next generation probiotics, they probably have great efficacy under particular contexts. So unless we have a good rational way of choosing the deployment of these interventions, it's going to be difficult to prove that they work well. And then, you know, the next big challenge here is how do you get through regulatory bodies these types of precision interventions. You know, what is the placebo? Like, how do you run the trial? How do you, what is the burden of proof to really take this from like kind of a wellness nutritional space into an actual clinical healthcare space? So there's a lot of challenges there, but, you know, I think that there's enough good to be done through this to save people, to like address these non-responders, these underserved populations who go to the doctor and are maybe gaslit a little bit about having symptoms and not being able to deal with them, like, you know, irritable bowel syndrome folks and so on. You know, I think there's a lot of good that we can do by pushing this stuff, even though it's going to be hard to make it a reality. I think it's going to be an exciting future.
That's a great note to finish on, I think, Sean. Thank you so much for taking part. It's really been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.